Hey, listener, this is ESPN Quick Info. I am Srinath Sripath, and you're listening to the Stump Mic Podcast. It's our first episode under a new name, but evidently not much has changed. It's the same crew, same chatter, except a couple of little updates from our end. Stump Mic will go beyond talking just T20. It will have a distinctly subcontinental flavor and be a regular fix of cricket talk on things that matter to you and things that you didn't know should matter from around the cricketing world, featuring our top writers and insiders, just like we had during the World Cup 2019. If you've been a talking T20 or a talking World Cup subscriber, don't need to do anything new. All these episodes will land on your feed as per usual. And if you're listening to us for the first time, welcome on board. Look for ESPN Quick Info Stump Mic wherever you get your podcasts. Onwards then to our first episode featuring Sid Monga and Fidel Fernando.
Siddharth Monga and Fidel Fernando, welcoming you to this podcast, this special podcast put together for a special innings. We're talking about one of the greatest innings ever played in Test cricket, perhaps the greatest. That's the question going around everywhere. It has come in an incredible chase in an era where teams are failing to chase 180. This is a century. This is a fourth inning century in a chase of 300 plus. It has come in the company of tail, with the tail enders hardly scoring any runs, but with this batsman taking charge of the situation against a great bowling attack, one of the greatest innings ever played. Arise, Sir Kusal.
Monga is kind of taking the piss, but the whole point of this podcast is that we've just seen two of the most insane innings to ever have been played in Test cricket. We had Kusal Pereira in February in Durban against the likes of Rabada, Steyn, Olivier, and we've, you know, in the last couple of days, we've had Stokes against Cummins, Hazelwood, and Pattinson and Lyon at Headingley. Obviously, the whole hook of this podcast is that we're trying to catch Stokes' innings. But can we just first reflect on the fact that we've seen these two innings? I mean, they're both like once-in-a-lifetime innings. I don't think, definitely with Kusal Pereira, you can say that he's never going to play as well ever again. With Stokes, maybe he'll, we don't really know where his ceiling is now because he keeps raising it, but I suspect that we'll never see something like this from him or anyone else in this England team or any team for the next 20 years. I don't think we'll see anything like that. And we've seen this once in a generation innings in the space of 6 months, and how incredibly lucky are we as cricket fans to have this happen to us?
I'll tell you how lucky we are. I've got numbers for that. Test cricket is, I don't know, 150 years old or something, and I'm just looking at how many test matches have been played in all. I'll come back to you with that number, but out of those many matches, about 2,357 test matches or 2,358 test matches have been played in all. Out of them, only 14 have ended in one-wicket wins. Out of which, only 4 of them have had a batsman not out on 100 or 100-plus seeing the team home. Out of those 4 innings, we have seen 2 of them in this year. That's how lucky we are. Just coming back to what you said, that we're not going to see it. Another of such an innings in another 20 years. I'm sure you must have thought the same when you saw Kusal Pereira bat in Durban.
There's just nothing that could have prepared you for that innings, because he is in no way a batsman that inspires any kind of sense of reliability, or he had no history of doing that before. And I think the thing with that innings was that you never really had hope until the last 15-20 runs, right? Like, maybe when it got to 40 runs for Sri Lanka to get, you suddenly started thinking, could this happen? But right through that chase, Sri Lanka were always behind the game. You had this amazing South African bowling attack. Steyn and one of the greatest of all time, well, one of the two or three greatest of all time, the half dozen greatest of all time. Rabada, who was one of the best at the time, and Olivier, who'd absolutely devoured Pakistan in the previous series. Against a batsman who, yeah, he'd scored a 50 in the first innings, but at no point in his Test career looked like the kind of player who could pull this off.
If we're talking history of these protagonists, I want to, and because the most immediate event is Ben Stokes' innings, I want to talk about what I've seen of Stokes over the years. I clearly remember the day after the 2016 World T20 final, where I didn't think he bowled a bad over. He started off really well, and he got hit for four sixes by Carlos Brathwaite. And after the second six, I think he had lost his composure, and he ended up just going for Yorkers and missing them. Next morning, can you imagine, both the teams are in the same hotel, and I was there to interview a couple of West Indies players. And I saw him in the morning, and he looked like he was gone. I really wondered how he would recover from that. I remember that morning, I think West Indies coach Phil Simmons took him aside, had a chat with him, and you just wondered what would happen. I've seen him on his haunches in that match. I've seen him in an IPL game where Jadeja and Mitchell Santner hit him for sixes in the last over. He'd obviously had his run-in with the law. There had been a lot going on in his life, and you wondered, you know, where the redemption is. And we are always looking for these redemption stories. First one of them came in the World Cup final, and we didn't think it could have been bettered. But here, and that image, I just juxtapose Stokes on his haunches in Kolkata after getting hit for four sixes, and Stokes in Headingley, at Headingley after hitting those winning runs. And not even those winning runs, even when he was at the non-striker's end and when Jack Leach was facing one or two balls that he would have to in most of the overs, he couldn't bear to look. He was on his haunches at the non-strikers, and he was looking at his shoelaces, and he couldn't. Like, it was so incredible that when he's at the other end, he's a god. He's doing whatever he wishes to do. Everything is just hitting it out of the screws, clean out of the screws. He's hit some incredible sixes, a reverse six, reverse sweep for a six over point. He's done everything from that end, and now at the other end, he shows his completely human side where he can't even bear to look. What a great human drama that this innings was, and this must finally be redemption for him for all that he has been through, and how much he has been through in his life in the last 3 years is just incredible.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's lived as much as Stokes in the last 3 years. From all those things you mentioned, you could live several lifetimes and not live as much as, and not be feel as alive as Stokes has in those last 3 years. I mean, just think about the summer you had. Like, if you had, when you grow up as a young cricketer aspiring to be in the national team, the thing that you most want to do is hit a winning innings in a World Cup final, right? Like, maybe in Australia and England it's the Ashes, but in the rest of the world it's a World Cup final.
But you don't dream of tying that World Cup final.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't win it. It wasn't a winning innings, but it was the most consequential innings that anyone played in that final. And so you do that, and you do extremely well in the Super Over as well. And then you just, you know, not even 2 months later, just several weeks later, you play the greatest innings that anyone in your country has played, and I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Well, that we can put to rest right away. It's easily better than what Botham did in 1981. Botham's innings was in the third innings. He had no clue what he was doing. Here, Ben Stokes could contemplate all the consequences of what he was doing. Even when they had set Australia 130 or whatever, they didn't know they were winning that game. They didn't know they were in the game. They just had a bit of fun when they were batting third and thinking, okay, let's see what happens. Here, this was such a calculated innings where he scored nothing in his first 50 balls. Then when Root got out, he became more urgent and he played like a normal test innings. And then after he ran out of batsmen to accompany him, he switched to this insane gear. This deliberateness of this innings, there's nothing to compare in history of cricket in England.
This, by the way, like, you cannot compare to innings of previous years, because they, like, previous eras didn't have T20. They didn't have this third gear that Stokes called on, which is basically like that last. I only watched the last 25-30 minutes because I was covering another test in Colombo, New Zealand versus Sri Lanka. But like the last few overs I watched, the scoop for six.
The reverse sweep for six.
The reverse sweep for six. Those are things that just could never have happened, and that are just massive spectacles in the game. And I think, like, if you actually, given the crowd that was in Headingley, I mean, there was that insane video of Stokes hitting that final ball for four. And he knows that he's hit it for four before anyone in the crowd does. And he starts celebrating, and then, you know, maybe not even a second later, maybe half a second later, the Headingley crowd rises onto its feet. Like, that is, it's just such a beautiful, it's just such a beautiful visual. Like, it's just something that even someone who's watched it will, it'll stay with you forever.
Like, even thinking about it is giving me goosebumps again. Just imagine being in that situation where you've, I mean, I don't know if it's a good comparison or if it's an accurate comparison, but Stokes was almost like some, like us, when we are in a tragedy, in a personal tragedy, and we have to get certain things done, something comes over us, we get possessed and we do those things. We don't know what we're doing, we just get them done. That's what I felt Stokes was doing at that point. And once it was done, the amount of... the exhaustion showed once it was done. He was not jumping around. He went down on his haunches. He was completely drained by the effort.
And I just remember that quote that Adam Gilchrist, who is the greatest test hitter that test six hitter that we've ever seen, has said, was that the best thing about hitting a six in cricket is that you know that it's a six before anyone else in the stadium.
Even if it's half a second, you know it.
You felt it come off your bat. You know exactly where it is going. And that that video of Stokes celebrating before the crowd just put that Gilchrist comment into the most visceral context, and just the entire the spectacle of that last 30 minutes is so unmatchable in cricket. Like, to have a full stadium, to have them absolutely baying for you, so few get to actually experience that. And Stokes was on top of that.
A lot of cricketers dream of that, but once they get into cricket teams and once they know what's there to lose, I'm not sure many of them want to be in that position actually, because once they've tasted the atmosphere, and then they know that a mistake can push you out of not just the team but out of reckoning for years, not many want to be in that situation. Not many want to risk those nightmares that Stokes has had in his past, as we have spoken about. But again, the willingness to be in that situation again and again, not many they're just scarred by those experiences. They're not willing, but this guy is always willing to be in those situations.
So this has turned into like a Ben Stokes appreciation, which I suspected it would, because this is like Stokes' innings is absolutely stunning. Can we, like, let's get down to, like, actually measuring what... Okay, the first thing that we could look at is which attack was better.
Oh, so we're getting to comparing it with Kusal, right?
Yes, yeah. We're getting down to actually comparing, trying to get a grip on which of these innings was better. If though, should we go down to, or should we go down, like, this Buddhist route of, like, finding the middle path and then walking through the valley of conflict and onto the mountain of peace, where we just say, no, both these innings are great in their own right, and can't we just stick with two great innings in different contexts, and do we really have to compare them?
I know a great line to end this discussion with, that it's it's a disservice, it's unfair to either of them, to both of them, to even compare them.
No, because I think like there are sports fans all over the world who compare everything to everything, right? Like, just in the last 24 hours, we've already seen many people claim this to be the greatest innings of all time.
Without even mentioning this innings, which is forgotten for some reasons, which we'll get to.
We'll get to that later in the podcast. But for now, let's talk about the actual cricket, right?
Yeah.
Kusal Perera's innings was against Dale Steyn, Kagiso Rabada, Dwan Olivier, Keshav Maharaj, right? And those were really the four bowlers. I wouldn't say that Philander was part of... Philander was playing that test. He bowled eight overs in that innings against Sri Lanka, but he was injured for most of that fourth innings, so we can't admit him. And he didn't bowl a single ball to Kusal Perera. I've checked that. So we can't admit him as having been a force against Perera in that innings. Steyn was not at his best, and we know that because in the previous series, he had 12 wickets at an average of 29 against Pakistan,
which is subpar.
When his average, which is for him is very very low in South Africa against a team like Pakistan. His South Africa average is I think about 10. Better than 29. I mean, it's not a shabby average by any means. Like, you average 29 in a series, any normal bowler will take that. But for Steyn, it was far below his best. Babar Azam had like a great series against him. But then you also had Olivier, who averaged 14.7 against Pakistan in that previous series. So his form was like right at his peak. Kagiso Rabada had 17 wickets against Pakistan at 18.7 and had a few wickets in the first innings as well. So they were, I mean, I think like it was still a very, very formidable attack. Also, Kingsmead Durban takes more turn than a lot of other pitchers in South Africa. Keshav Maharaj was genuinely very good, and he also took, before Kusal really went crazy, he took 3 wickets. He's maybe not as highly rated a spinner as Nathan Lyon is, if we're going to refer to Stokes, but he is still a very good and developing spinner on the world stage. So I think on balance, I think it was an outstanding attack that Kusal Perera faced, but maybe even given the names that you mentioned and the names that you see on the scorecard, it probably wasn't as tough for him as you suspect that it might have been at a first class scorecard.
I mean, if Philander had been fit, if they had Philander, this I would say both the attacks are on an even level. But I would say Australia's attack was slightly better than the one that Kusal faced. Cummins is one of the highest ever ranked bowlers, highest ever rated bowlers by the ICC. Cummins is pretty much what Rabada is. But they had Australia had Hazelwood bowling at his best in the first innings, and Pattinson is a great bowler when he is fit, and he was fit here. So and Lyon is one of the best spinners to have ever played.
So I think if you're just looking at the attacks and not looking at the surfaces that they played on, I think I would definitely agree that Australia had a tougher task of it. However, Steyn is a really interesting one because you can never discount the experience that he has, right? Like more than 420 odd test wickets. It's hard to discount that experience, and even so many bowlers, when they're not at their best, they rely on that experience and they test batsmen in different ways, and Steyn is the absolute best example of that in the last 15 years, in that he had so many weapons, and despite the fact that he wasn't taking so many wickets, I was definitely there and I was witness to the fact that he was bowling at over 140 kph, so he wasn't that far down on pace. He wasn't getting up to 150, which he was at his best, but he was still no slouch. So I'd probably agree with you on that, in that if you just look at the attacks, the Australian one was probably better. Mainly because of Lyon. I would say Lyon is,
because
for me,
Lyon had everything that you say about Steyn. The one thing that I think Pereira had going for him is it was an away test.
So that I think is the main thing, and I think this is a very significant thing because Sri Lanka just aren't expected to win in South Africa, and this particular Sri Lanka team was not in any way supposed to win in South Africa. They were in absolute shambles, in complete disarray. The coach was completely under pressure. I spoke to Chandika Hathrusinghe before this match, and he was saying, we just need to try and find a way to compete, right? Like, when you're just saying, we're not trying to win, we're just trying to compete, you know that you're in a tough place. And that's the coach saying that. And Sri Lanka had only won one test in South Africa before. Obviously, England have won many tests in England and at Headingley. There was serious bounce, serious pace going into the last day. I don't recall ever Quinton de Kock taking balls near his ankles at any stage of the match. It was always good pace and carry, which you don't see. It was not in any way like Asian conditions. Kusal Pereira would have been very uncomfortable. He was very uncomfortable at the start of the innings. He wore a few balls. Dwan Olivier hit him on the head. Kagiso Rabada, I think, also hit him on the helmet. Steyn would have hit him on the arm. There were so many balls that he wore on the body or on some part of his anatomy or equipment. And this is a lot of people say context matters, and I want to bring this context into it, is that I think 13 or 14 days before this, and there was a very short turnaround between the Australia tour that Sri Lanka were on and the South Africa tour. Kusal Pereira was hit on the side of the head, right, on the side of the helmet, and he had his ear guard disintegrate as a result of that blow. This was in Canberra, I believe, and he batted on after that blow, but he looked incredibly groggy at the other end, and he failed a concussion test subsequent to that blow. So he stayed on in the immediate aftermath, but then as he was walking off, he just looked like he was just, his head was not in it. He was not stable. He was not steady. And then 14 days after that, he was wearing blows on the body from Steyn Rabada, Olivier, right? All 140 kph plus bowlers.
Man, these similarities are so uncanny. Just on this morning of the final day in Headingley, Stokes was hit on the helmet and his helmet was like in pieces. Unreal similarities between these two innings and the situations and the positions the teams were in. But yeah, I think the one thing that again had, one thing going for Pereira again is that he did not have as much support as Stokes had. Stokes came in after a good partnership that between Root and Denley that had sort of settled England down a little, sort of given them belief. Pereira had no reason to believe that they could win or they could come close to it.
Yeah, he had a 96-run stand with Dhananjay da Silva. I don't think even at the end of that stand, anyone really thought, like I certainly didn't think that Sri Lanka, I mean, I was just expecting to write a normal Sri Lanka post-mortem, which is they're playing an away test and they lost.
So, but that stand came from 110 for 5. Which is when, which means you've lost your fifth wicket, needing 200 runs. England lost Root the fourth wicket when the target had come to within 200, and they'd had like two decent partnerships, and they had, and as we know, England have like a deeper batting lineup than Sri Lanka. So the match situation, strictly speaking, it was less likely for Pereira to win it easily. Easily less likely for Pereira to win it than Stokes.
Yeah, that Sri Lanka tale is in no way respectable. Like, Jack Leach scored a 92. And Jack Leach is not a great first-class player, so let's not overstate Jack Leach's batting, and we'll get to Jack Leach later in the podcast. But he'd at least at the top level scored a 92 against Ireland a couple of weeks beforehand. We can suggest that he was in some kind of decent batting form. which we can't really say for many members of this Sri Lankan tale. Cousin Rajitha, Usha Fernando, absolute bunnies, right? Like absolute rabbits or whatever you want to call them. They're not in any way comparable to this England tale, which Stokes can put a little bit of trust on.
You spoke of context and you spoke of how Sri Lanka had no reason to believe that they could win. They were the, as, and you quoted the coach saying that they were actually hoping to compete and then see what happens. Which is where I think Stokes scores over Pereira's effort is the old nothing to lose versus all to lose debate. I still believe Pereira's innings came in a nothing to lose situation. If they had lost the test, so what? Everybody goes to, every Asian team goes to South Africa and loses a test. You know, it wouldn't have been that big a blow to Sri Lanka if they'd lost the test. So, but whereas for England, this is a summer where everything, if a cricket is supposed to come home, they won the World Cup, everybody is knocking them, they're almost on the verge of losing the Ashes in a home series, which has not happened in a while. Everybody is on their backs. And then in that situation, Stokes is playing this innings where every moment he's dealing with the consequences, dealing with the possibilities. He's dealing with, hey, I'm getting close. I could actually win this. So he's contemplating that. Whereas Pereira might not have. Pereira might have thought, okay, let's see what happens.
Okay, so my counterpoint to that is that Sri Lanka had not won a single match, test match, T20, one day, they had not won a single game since October, right? So they'd probably be playing like tic-tac-toe against each other in the dressing room and they'd both find a way to lose. It was like that. It was like that kind of
dire
situation.
The wind would blow the paper away.
Yeah, they just had a change in captains because they had gone through this losing streak. And so Chandimal had just got sacked as captain and Divan Kalaratne had just been brought in. So it was like the Sri Lanka team was... Stokes was just staving away turmoil. The Sri Lanka team was already in turmoil, right?
Yeah.
So, and Stokes had won a World Cup 2 months before. Like even if England lose this Ashes... Their summer may not be a roaring success, but they would have got a lot out of it, right? Like, it's not a complete failure. If Sri Lanka lose this match, it's hard to see them winning the next one, which they eventually went on to do. I don't know. I don't really buy that context argument that Stokes's innings was tougher because of context, because Kusal's innings had a lot of context behind it, and there was a lot of odds that he had to fight to get into the space that he got to win that match.
So look, but I'm not denying this. I'm not denying the how deliberate that effort from Pereira was. It's just that he hadn't been in this situation as often as Stokes, and he hadn't seen failure from these situations before. He doesn't know what it feels like. And you just imagine being Stokes in that last over of Lions that he tried the reverse sweep and Leach was very nearly run out. All those memories would have come back. All those near wins would have come back to Stokes' mind. Pereira's mind was not scarred that way.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough.
Whether that
in this situation before. I don't actually remember any time that he'd been batting with the tail before, and Stokes would have done it many, many times. So yeah, I mean that's fair enough.
I think Stokes would have, in lifetime, when it was happening, Stokes would have had more, would have realized the significance of this innings more than Pereira would have while it was happening. Pereira would have definitely, after winning the game, having come to within 10 runs of winning, he would have realized, wow, what the hell have I just done? But while the innings was happening, I think Stokes had more reason to start realizing, weighing the scope of what was happening.
So I don't think Pereira actually realized the scope of what he was doing even after it happened. So I was there at Durban. I was the only Sri Lankan journalist, and Kusal Pereira doesn't speak amazing English. He speaks a little bit, but it was basically down to me to go down to the ground right after the presentation and interview him. he didn't come to a press conference. And it didn't seem like he actually understood what the momentousness of his innings was. He didn't really... And it's understandable for a player who's never played anything of that quality before. He didn't know that even at that stage, after Sri Lanka had won the match, how incredibly rare it is for a player to have done that and to have achieved what he did against such massive odds. But again, that doesn't diminish his innings so much for me, because part of what makes great innings great is that people refuse to understand the odds, right? Like, if you understood the odds, you might not even be doing it. And so we don't actually know what Stokes thought about his own innings while he was playing it. We literally just do not know.
At the end of this year, we'll both be voting for the Cricinfo innings of the year. And I might still be inclined to vote for Pereira at 1 and Stokes at 2. But only slightly.
Yeah, I don't think if there's one thing to take away from this podcast is that there's literally so little to take away, to divide between these two innings, because, and a lot of it could be subjective. I don't think it's a fruitful exercise to try and be objective about sports, because so much of what attracts us to sport is emotional. If our emotions weren't attached to cricket, there'd just be 22 guys playing a bat and ball game on the field and none of us should care about it. But we like it because our emotions are invested in it. And if you're a fan who cares so much about England cricket and you saw Stokes play their innings, that would be the best thing in the world. And you would, and you could never, and you know, you might not have watched Kusal Perez, you might have watched it, but it would never have drawn that emotional response from you. And you just prefer Stokes' innings based on the way it made you feel, and I completely understand that.
And we must say that, at least I feel that way, that we're sounding like doing both the innings a disfavor here by becoming so objective and so clinical about discussing them. I mean, when I was watching it, both innings gave me that incredible joy. It felt great to be a part, of, you know, watching it live while everybody else was watching it live. And at that moment, I didn't think, hey, let's compare. It was just pure joy of just being part of Stokes' redemption after having seen him go through so many failures in cricket and then achieving this, after having seen Sri Lanka struggle for 6 months without a win in international cricket and then doing it. It was just unparalleled, pure joy watching these two innings. So, and none of this is diminishing any of the innings. We're just talking, I think, because they're so similar, we're talking about them in the same podcast. We did ask on Cricinfo, we asked the readers to vote which is the best innings they have seen and which is the best innings according to them.
And obviously, because our readers are the best, they would have seen every single one of those innings and be like fully aware of the context of all those innings. So I'm sure that the poll will throw out like a completely accurate answer.
I'll just say what we shortlisted. We, apart from these two innings, we had Brian Lara's 153 in Bridgetown, which we never thought it could be bettered.
If someone says that's the best one, like, you can't actually argue that. And you also can't argue if someone says Lakshman's 281 is difficult to come up against those two innings, because they came...
This poll, our criteria is fourth innings. Lakshman is third innings, so we have not included that innings.
Okay, Lakshman's not even a part of it. Okay.
His innings in Mohali, where he actually started swearing at Pragyan Oja with stumps, yeah, capturing it all, is all there. Then there's Inzi against Bangladesh, crushing the hopes and dreams of Bangladesh cricket, setting them back by about 20 years with that one innings. Then, of course, there's Mahela against Stain and Pollock and Entini. Gilchrist in Hobart, I think he, again, this innings benefited from an umpiring mistake very early on. And then Ponting again, setting Bangladesh cricket back and Fatullah Abbas scoring 118. So, but anyway, the readers have voted 13,900 votes for Kusal and 9,600 votes for Ben Stokes.
Oh, so Kusal is leading.
Yes.
This is not something I expected. No, I fully didn't expect, because there's recency bias. There's also like more people watch the Ashes than a Sri Lanka South Africa series. So I probably wouldn't say that there's such a gap that there should be like a 13,000, 8,000.
Then the recency bias shows in how Brian Lara has got only 6,600 votes.
Yeah, okay, no, that's insane. That's sorry, readers, you've got this. There's I can't trust this poll anymore. So the thing I would say about Brian Lara innings is I was reminded of it by the Stokes innings, in the fact that I think Lara had, towards the end, a couple of let-offs, or at least he was dropped by Healy, I think, which is like one of the most unlikely things to ever have happened. Like, Healy does not drop the kind of catches that he dropped in that match. And then obviously Stokes had that LBW referral, which he claims hit his front pad first. I don't know how physically a ball hits your front pad first and then straightens.
No, it did. It did hit the front pad, and I think from whatever replays I've seen, the Hawkeye stopped the point of impact at the front pad. I think.
Okay. Oh, okay. So are you saying that the DRS got it right?
So what's up for debate is whether, like, visually for us, they stopped it there, but the projection failed. That's up for doubt and debate, whether the projection failed to take mind of that deflection. But they knew the point of impact was front pad.
So if the front point of impact was front pad, so I don't see how it would go further down leg side if it hit front pad and then back pad. So I would be inclined to suggest that, yeah, okay, Ben Stokes is telling the truth in the fact that it hit his front pad first, but he's wrong on it having a wrong projection, because if it hits your front pad and then your back pad, it's much more likely to go down leg than actually straighten, which is what Lyon's delivery did.
I have reason to believe, in terms of projections, I have good reason to believe technology more than human eye.
Yeah.
Unless somebody expressly says, hey, we made a mistake, I'm happy to go with what we have been shown.
So Kusal's innings was like fully chanceless. There was not a single time that South Africa could have got him burnt reviews, not burnt reviews, drop catches, not drop catches. There was just not one. That is an interesting thing. I think you also have to bring that into the debate, where he just played this absolute blinder, and South Africa couldn't actually match him on the day, no matter what they tried.
Yes, which is why, all things considered, I would still vote Pereira slightly ahead of Stokes. Slightly, ever so slightly.
My personal view is that, yes, Stokes would have been playing the more informed attack, but Kusal Pereira having been away, that is the thing probably that seals it for me. But I completely understand when people say, no, Stokes is the one that resonated more with me. That is the one that enjoyed more. And I was fully on the enjoyment wagon in the last 20-30 minutes that I watched. I wish I'd watched more of Stokes' innings, but that was the only, you know, period I actually was in. I was still in the press box actually while I was watching it, but it was just absolutely phenomenal, and we're so lucky to have had both those in the same year. I think the best thing about both those innings though was the number 11s, and I think we should drop into Jack Leach and Vishwa Fernando, who played two quite different number 11 innings, both legendarily courageous, and both courageous for different reasons. Like Jack Leach, I don't think there's a greater image in Test cricket or in cricket this year. And you take that like Guptill run out in the final during the Super Over. That's like I think it was the Sunday Times in the UK ran a wonderful front page based on that. And there have been some incredible sporting images this year, but I don't think there's an image that speaks more to me as a human being than Jack Leach cleaning his glasses in the final stages of that innings, and I would like you wear your wearing glasses right now, so I want to go to you to actually get your personal thing. But as someone who has never worn spectacles before, that image spoke to me than anything I've seen in cricket this whole year.
It spoke to me more than it did to you, because I've been wearing glasses since, I think at some point in school I started wearing glasses. In every sport I've played, I've struggled with this. I mean, watching it was so much, it told me, hey, this is a test cricketer facing same issues. Every sport I've played, I have struggled with if there's a smudge. I just truly dreaded getting a smudge on my glasses, because I didn't know how to clean them. I still don't know how that cloth did it, because even today, if there's a smudge on my glasses, I have to use the solution to spray on it and then clean it. It doesn't clean itself with any cloth. That cloth, I mean, must be doing its job really well. It's to have somebody wearing glasses and doing this job. Oh man, it was just great fun to watch. Every time he came on strike, he removed his helmet, he started cleaning his glasses. Like, not all superheroes wear capes. They sometimes carry a cloth to clean their glasses.
The thing that, like, as a non-glasses wearer who doesn't have first-hand experience, what struck me was just how that moment transported you out of that context, right? Like, it was just a man cleaning his glasses, which you see at the library, right? People who wear spectacles, I've seen them use that when they've heard that they've just lost their job, and they're just using that moment to compose themselves before they can sort of find a response to what the situation their life is, right? And it was just it was a moment where we were all living it with him, and it was so humanizing. You felt complete empathy for him while you were watching that, and because he was so out of his depth doing what he did, and I didn't personally see him tremble, but I've read that other people saw him tremble, and I would be absolutely crapping myself in that situation. Like, it's just something that you're not built, you're not capable of countering, right? Like, 90 plus miles an hour, 145 plus miles kph an hour bowling. You're a number 11. You have to stick out there for your friend, who's on the verge of doing something truly amazing, truly unforgettable, and you, as someone who is not equipped to do that, has to deal with all these emotions, all these expectations, the crowd outside, the Australia players sledging the crap out of him. How do you deal with that emotionally? And that moment to take off his glasses and clean them was something that I think anyone on planet Earth can relate to. You might watch Stokes's innings, you might not know anything about cricket, but that moment where, and you might not connect with anything of what Stokes did if you don't know what cricket is, but that moment of Jack Leach, everybody can connect to that.
And that's one of the things about cricket, where you put these guys there and then these guys will fight and fight and fight. And sometimes you'll have your typical courageous big guys doing it, and sometimes you'll have Jack Leach coming out. I mean, look at him. There's nothing that tells you he's a... In modern sports image, there's nothing about Jack Leach that tells you he'll be a hero in such a big contest that had the attention of the whole world. He's bald. He wears glasses.
Yeah.
He's not a fast bowler.
He bowls
innocuous left arm spin. And
he's the kind of person who'd look more at home in like a turtleneck than like a cricket jersey or any kind of sporting jersey.
Although I don't think he was trembling. I just thought, having seen it, I don't think he was trembling. I just thought that he was shuffling across to counter the short pitch bowling into his rib to get inside the line. which worked to his peril in the first innings, where I think Hazelwood tried the full ball on the leg stump and bowled him. Australia tried it here, but this time he was not shuffling that much.
I think he was shaken. I think he was quite shaken towards the end of that innings, and he's not a completely out of his depth batsman in the sense that he'd scored 92 in Test cricket a few weeks ago. So he's not completely unequipped, but at the same time, he did do some sort of panic things. But the fact that he was able to maintain his composure enough to allow Stokes to provide that ending, in a sense, like if your fears are quite obvious and you conquer your fears, that is like insanely courageous, right? Like that is a very, very strong message to all of us, and kind of a lesson to all of us about conquering our fears and doing things for your teammates and your friends, even though you have huge apprehensions about all those things. I think Vishal was completely different. It was a hugely different innings, in the sense that Vishal, like Kusal, didn't really know what he was getting dropped into, and he didn't appreciate, like, okay, this is a all-time great bowler, this is one of the best bowlers in the world in terms of Rabada, and this is a bowler in the form of his life in Dwan Olivier who could really hurt me. But they did hurt him, because they hit him quite a few times on the body during that partnership. He faced 10 more balls than Leach. Leach faced 17 balls, Vishal faced 27. And the most incredible thing about that partnership, I think, is that Vishal was the one who was sort of assuring Kusal that it's okay, I'm going to stick around, you do what you need to do. And the great line that came out of it was, in Sinhala, it was, Pairin Nepa Kusalaya, I'm Anging Hari Gahannam, which means, don't worry, Kusal, I'll hit it with my body if nothing else. Yeah, I'll get hit, I'll survive, it's fine. Don't worry about what you need me to do, I'll do what needs to happen. And it's, I think that's, as great as that image was, I think like that is the greatest image, the Jack Leach image. I don't think there's a greater line that's been spoken in cricket this year than that one. Vishal, I think, has a first class average of less than 10, which is quite rare these days. Like to have a first class average of less than 10, most players breach that mark. His high score is of 35 in first class cricket. He was like completely unequipped. And to be honest, the South Africa bowlers were way too good for him. If they had like, this is where I think maybe they could have had, maybe Philander could have made a difference, is that Philander or Colin de Gronholm would have nicked Vishal off, because there were so many plays and misses in that 27 balls. But this is what happens in Test cricket. As much as England got lucky with the run outs and the dropped chances and the umpiring mistakes, Sri Lanka got lucky that Philander wasn't there when, and in that five or six overs where he might have been able to make the difference and nick Vishal off, and you never know how that would have turned out. Maybe Kusal Pereira would have played Philander's overs perfectly, because at that stage of the innings, Philander would have been the worst bowler to have there, because Steyn and Olivier and Rabada were clearly better at that stage of the innings. But maybe toward just to Vishwa, having someone who didn't move the ball as much as those bowlers did, would have, and weren't bowling as fast as those bowlers did, would have been a difference. Though Maharaj did bowl to Vishwa and couldn't get him out. So, yeah, it's such a hard thing to call, man. The number 11 innings are my two favorite things that I've seen this year. Like Kusal Pereira, Ben Stokes, great, like amazing cricketing things. But in terms of like just human stories about about people, and Vishwa is like not, and like Vishwa for all his like his bullishness during that innings and all his bravery and courageousness, he is not like he is not a player or a person who is who you know talks himself up, who believes himself to be like better than he is. It was just willing himself to be part of a win at that point. Like I've seen him many times. Actually, a few days after that, I'd already interviewed him a couple of days after that win.
We know somebody who gets even more pissed off with this, and we will let him end this podcast. This is a very special message from Usman Samiuddin that will follow our farewells to you. Thanks for joining us. Any final word, Fernando?
No, just that we are living, I feel, in the best year that Test cricket has had in a long time, and I hope that people appreciate that and that fans can get behind it. And today I just watched New Zealand close out a Test match against Sri Lanka in like quite clinical style, and Sri Lanka played terribly, but New Zealand have been doing this for quite a few years, and you've got things like New Zealand just like New Zealand's home summer, by the way, will be fire because they're playing England and then India later in the summer, but they're in the middle they've got an Australia tour. I will like fully be glued on that. Sri Lanka are playing some abysmal and incredible test match, test cricket at the same time, sometimes in the same match. They're hard to tear your eyes from as well. And you've got the Ashes, we've still got two tests of the Ashes going on. West Indies have been having a resurgence, so hopefully they'll have a better showing in that second India match than they did in the first one. There's just no better time to be watching test cricket. We've got Bangladesh blowing things up as well. I just hope that people don't get caught up in this partisan crap and think that this is the only series that matters. There is a big wide test world out there. I hope we can all enjoy it.
Definitely, yeah, definitely as good a time as I have seen in test cricket since I started covering cricket. On that note, thank you everyone, and it's over to Usman now.
Thanks, guys. So all I really wanted to say is that, you know, if the reflex reaction to such a great test match and such a great innings is to use it as proof that test cricket is not dead or it's not dying, then I think there's a problem with the cricket fraternity. Like, not the format itself, but actually the way the cricket fraternity is. Maybe we're just really morbid in that, you know, you seek constant affirmation that something is not dead when something becomes beautiful, and you start like missing the actual beauty of these. You people don't see like the beauty of the game, and they start seeing it only in reference to its continuing death. You know, a lot of the reaction right after this test, and there was a lot of it from around the world, by the way. It's not restricted to any one like nationality or any one region. It's from around the world, from players, from ex-players. You know, it was like, this test is proof that test cricket is alive and not dying, and who said test cricket was dying? And, you know, most of the time it's the people themselves who are saying this who have said that test cricket is dying. I'm not arguing that test cricket has not suffered, maybe, but I would argue it, but not here is what I'm saying. I would argue it. You know, there's been some great test cricket over the last year, but I'm just more like annoyed about the kind of gloom that it surrounds every conversation. So, you know, last year when New Zealand had that great win in Abu Dhabi in the UAE, even then it was like, oh, you know, this is proof, even though nobody's watching it at the grounds, this is proof that test cricket is still alive and kicking. I mean, yes, it is alive and kicking. You know, half the world is busy playing the goddamn game and the format. And we're just kind of getting on with playing a lot of the players are just getting on with playing the format. It is alive. So let's leave it at that. You know, let's celebrate Stokes' innings for what it was. Let's celebrate the test match for what it was. Let's celebrate other test matches that have been close. Other great series this year and the last year. New Zealand, Sri Lanka and South Africa. There's been so much amazing stuff happening. It doesn't need to be linked to the fact that the format may or may not be dying. And in any case, now we have, you know, this great context of the World Test Championship. So at least for the next 4 years, that's two cycles of the World Test Championship. I would assume, you know, given there is no drastic change at the ICC or in administration generally, and there may well be, but given that there's not, I'd like to think of the glasses half full. Given that there's not, the next 4 years, we've got two league cycles of the World Test Championship. So Test cricket is not going anywhere. There'll be a little less of it, but hopefully it comes with a bit more context. So please, let's just stop, like, seeking affirmation of its being alive in every innings, every great innings, every great test match. Appreciate the great innings. Appreciate the great test match. Yeah, get into arguments about whether Stokes was better than Pereira or whether Pereira was better than Stokes. I don't mind that so much, although even that gets a little bit tiresome. But anyway, but just appreciate it for what it is. You know, we've got three formats. We'll have a fourth next year, and people can love all of them or one of them or none of them, and it's absolutely fine. But just get on with enjoying it rather than seeking affirmation of life from these great moments.